It's a good week to talk about equanimity with everything changing. The teaching on equanimity comes as the conclusion not only of the list of the four Brahmavihara, the heart practices, but it's the conclusion of several of the doctrinal lists in early Buddhism. So it's the final or ultimate of the seven factors of enlightenment, and it shows up in a sequence of insights that leads to the opening into liberation, release from suffering as one of the final steps. And this is partly because as a heart quality, it's a profoundly mature quality, and it takes a lot of practice to develop. At the heart of the Buddhist revelation is an insight into how grasping arises as a result of reactivity to pleasant experience. And aversion or fear or resistance arises as a result of or in reactivity to unpleasant experience. And that delusion or confusion or spacing out arises as a result of or in reactivity to the neutral or experience that doesn't grab our attention in the way that pleasure and pain do. And so if these are the cause of suffering, then the whole of the path is oriented toward equanimity in a certain way. That we're instructed to develop the strength of mind and heart to bear and inquire into and focus in relation to pleasure and pain in such a way that we, and I just really like the word mature or grow or open in relation to them, that these ancient habits or karmas really of grasping and aversion and delusion that they lose, as we practice, their grip on the heart. And this takes practice over and over and over and over, right? Like, in a way, I think this practice of growing up from grasping is like the developmental process of growing up as a human being. That we grow out of identities we held on to when we were young, we grow out of youthful passions and fears. We don't have the same worries we had when we were 6 or 16, hopefully. We don't have the same delights either. Right now my toddler is utterly delighted with his new scooter. He'd been stealing scooters from other kids at the park for months. And then weeping because the sense of ownership is starting to come alive in him also. So the other kid would come for their scooter and take it away, and he would just look at it wistfully. And he would point to himself and be like, "Rivi?" And then just point to the scooter. You know, like, "I want that." And I'm like, "Welcome, self. Like, this is it. Here you come. You know, here's... I, me, and mine, like appearing, you know, in the field of being a toddler." So we got him one finally, you know, and we got him a hot pink little three-wheel scooter, and he's thrilled, you know, he's riding it around the house. Then he wants to, when we take him in the stroller, he wants to hold it, and then when he goes anywhere, he wants to just ride it around. And particularly, his favorite thing right now is he's figured out how to not only ride it, but to coast. So he pushes for a while, and then he gets on it, and he coasts. And when he's not pushing and just riding and, like, gliding along, his whole face lights up. He's just like, "Wow, you know, I have arrived in human life," you know. That's me projecting. But he looks really happy. So, you know, and then the other day at the park, some other kid, well, we were off trying to like find blackberries, and some other kid got on his scooter, and he suddenly looked over, and this other kid was riding his scooter, and he was just like, you know, like, really, me, that's mine. And I was like, yeah, yeah, you know, that other kid is, I explain it to him, the other kid's riding it, it is yours. And this is identity in a way, right? Like, here comes I and mine. And we have to do it, right? It's not like, I was joking with another Buddhist teacher about this exact thing. And we were like, oh, yeah, you know, you could be like the bad Buddhist parent and be like, no, there's no ownership. There's no identity. Everything is just empty. The scooter comes and goes, and, you know. Right? So hashtag bad Buddhist parent. Parenting. It's part of the developmental process. And one of my passions when I was about that age, a little bit older, I think I was 5 when Star Wars came out, was I had this plastic Millennium Falcon. It was about yay big. I mean, given that I was this big, it was like probably like yay big. And I remember holding it in 2 hands. It had all these like little pokey bits. And I was sort of flying it around the way the Millennium Falcon flies around. I loved that thing. Whatever happened to it? Like, I don't even know the last time I played with it. I wasn't conscious of like, oh, this is the last time. Right? I probably played with it and then went on to something else and just never came back to it. Yeah? Did I let it go on purpose? Was I like, no, I must release my attachment to the Millennium Falcon model. I didn't, right? I just grew into something else. I was into whatever was next. One of my teachers said, oh, I never let go of anything. Right? We talk all so much about letting go in yogic practice, in Buddhist practice. He said, I never let go of anything. And which speaks to this mystery that, like, we can't really let go volitionally. You can't just decide that you're done being obsessed by something and then bravo, Bing, magic, you're done. Right? We practice to set up the conditions for letting go to happen on its own. Right? So, you know, so much of our practice is to reflect in this kind of analytical way, in a sort of emotional analytical way, on the things that grab us and to intend, you know, non-harming, kindness, generosity, letting go. And then things let go when they let go, right? If you think about the moment you broke up with a lover or a partner, probably, almost certainly, the moment of breaking up, I point to my mouth, because we used to break up verbally, now you just text them, right? I don't know, I haven't broken up with someone in a long time, thankfully. May it not happen now. But I remember the moment of speaking, you know, oh, I think it's time for us to not be lovers anymore. But of course, that's not the moment where you let go. Sometimes you're saying it because you've come to threshold with it and you actually let go a long time before, hopefully not a long, long time. But that the speaking of it is actually the kind of maturing into form of a letting go that has already happened. Or sometimes you haven't actually let go, but one of you figures out that it's probably the right thing to do anyway. And you do it trying to set up the conditions for letting go in the heart to happen. You're like, you know, this isn't good for me. We should just close this chapter. And you might go on being like, oh, I want it. And time goes on, you know. And at some point, letting go happens. So all of that is embedded in this, like, grasping gives rise to suffering equation that's at the heart of practice. And then the Buddha says equanimity, this quality of equanimity. What is that? If I think back to, you know, being just, like, mad about Star Wars, and it was all Star Wars, you know, instead of pin the tail on the donkey at a birthday party, we had pin the lightsaber on Darth Vader. That was our game. It was a good game, right? And then it's, Anyway, kids like stumbling around with a blindfold, you know, and a tack. It's dangerous. Aiming for something. Not only do I not really remember when I let go, but I know that I did, partly because when I think of those things, it doesn't grip my heart in the way that it surely did at that time. And how I know that it doesn't grip my heart is that when I think of that whole era, even if I think of how passionate I was about it, there's a kind of soft, open, simple quietness in my heart around it. I neither long for that feeling again, nor do I push it away. It's like, yes, that's true. That was true. And I don't need to do anything with it any longer. And I can think about some of my lovers or partners, especially the ones where the relationship came to some kind of appropriate or fullness kind of conclusion. Not the ones that ended like messy and there was heartbreak and that for a long time. The ones that were like, oh, we did that. It's over. And whatever process happened, it was enough to complete the karma, we would say. And so now when I think back on them, my heart neither wishes it was still happening or worries about how it ended or frets. The heart doesn't grasp or push away. And this is what I'll call letting go. I didn't let go, or I couldn't volitionally let go, but letting go happened through the process of completing that which needed to be completed, coming to the end of threads of feeling, and then resting in non-delusion about it. Neither pushing it away nor holding on. So why is this one of the heart qualities? It's clearly a wisdom quality, right? It deals with seeing very clearly the nature of grasping and suffering. Why is it a heart quality? When we do the Brahmavihara or the divine abiding practice in sequence, we start with generating this like amazing, loving, warm, friendly feeling, right? Loving all beings equally, adoring the people we adore in a kind of unconditional way. And then we cultivate the two poles of meeting experience fully. Love meeting suffering turns into compassion. Love meeting good fortune turns into joy. And in a way, the heart gets both stirred into its fullness through attention and care, and then opened in both directions, right? To be able to meet suffering without wilting or running away or fading in some way, losing its strength, and to be able to meet joy without clenching or grasping or wanting. And all three of these can be cultivated in the context of meditative absorption, so very, very strong qualities with a very focused mind. And these are some of the easiest and most lovely doorways into what's known as absorption or jhana or dhyana practice. You can use them to cultivate a very strong foundation for concentration, partly because they feel so good. Having done that, like warmed up the heart and then opened it to pleasure and pain in this kind of gorgeous way, then what do? Right? Then we turn toward neither. And equanimity, in a sense, doesn't turn away from pleasure and pain. But thank you so much. But also doesn't lean into them in the same way. Sometimes when I'm at the playground, I guess it's all toddler stories today. Sometimes when I'm at the playground, especially when there's a bunch of kids playing and my kid is doing well, you know, like he's secure in himself, he's running around, he's doing things, there's other parents all around. So you really have the sense that he's safe, the space is safe, it's enclosed, there's no cars, there's no, you know, overt evil, God willing. There never will be. And sometimes I'll just, because I don't want to, like, helicopter him, that thing. So I just sit on a bench, and I kind of watch the whole thing unfold. And then it's like, you know, kids are zipping around on scooters, kids are going down the slide, some kid is just standing in the middle of an open field crying, you know, somebody's melting down, somebody's having a snack, somebody wants a ball, somebody's running away with the ball, somebody's throwing sand in an ecstatic sand trance. It's all sort of happening, the kid world. And when it's well contained, I can just be like, this is great. It's no problem. And like the kids that are crying and having a meltdown, it's no problem. This is part of the process. I care, like I'm, you know, and if they were in danger, I would leap in, but I don't have to constrict myself in relation to their feeling of not getting what they want in this moment. And the kids that are having a great time, I don't need to run over with my phone. I mean, I do sometimes, but I don't have to. The number of toddler videos I have is absurd. But it's such a delight, right? So the videos come from the appreciative joy side, like, oh my God, something great is happening, I want to film of it. The equanimity side is actually like when I don't need to do that. It's fine. He can have a fabulous moment and it doesn't need to be filmed. He can fall over and get an owie and it doesn't need to be like scooped up. He gets up, he dusts off his hands, he keeps going. And I just chill on the bench. Sometimes there's another parent there, they're chilling, and I'm just like, hey. And they're like, hey. You know, and there's like nothing to do in this delightful way. So equanimity, what if it were possible to rest in that quality of heart more of the time, much of the time, all of the time, while you're watching the news, while you're hearing about your friends' new love or a new heartbreak, while you're getting bad news from Blue Shield, when someone you love tells you really hard news, what would it be like to be able to care and swoop in when needed, but not be dragged off center by the reality of the world that has all those things in it? Equanimity is a heart quality because it's actually profoundly loving to give others and ourselves space to live. It's loving to allow the kids to just figure it out and to be the right distance away. There's a kind of generosity of heart that happens when we recognize that we can't save anybody else. We serve, we help, we meet with love, we challenge, we do all sorts of things, but we can't fix or save someone else's life. As I said before, often I do this series of chants in the morning that we do sometimes here, called the Five Recollections, that starts off with the recollection of old age, sickness, and death. And it says, this body, or I, you know, am subject to aging. I have not gone beyond aging. I am subject to sickness. I have not gone beyond sickness. I am subject to death. I have not gone beyond death. And the fourth one is a reminder of loss. All that I love, beloved and pleasing, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will be separated from me. Right? It's not dark, it's just honest. Everything unfolds in its own way and is lost eventually. And the last one is the phrase that is the stock phrase for equanimity. So it goes like this. All beings are the owners of their own actions. And the word actions is karma. So you could also say the owners of their own karma. All beings are the owners of their actions. They are born of their actions. They are the heirs to their actions, related to their actions, and abide supported by their actions. In other words, all beings, their appearance in this world, their family relations, or their connections relationally, their inheritance, or what they are given by the world, and the constant or ongoing support they receive in the world, all of this is hinged on their own actions. This is a delicate teaching. I'll say a little more about it in a second. So all beings are the owners of their actions, heirs to their actions, related to their actions, abide supported by their actions. And then really the equanimity phrase, whatever they do, for good or for ill, to that they will be the heir. It really reminds us that our actions that harm or help always give rise to future mind states in ourselves and others, of course. The great danger in this teaching is that we might think, that, first of all, that it blames people for their own suffering. Right? We might misinterpret it to say the entirety of a person's experience depends on their own actions. And that's not what it says. In many other places, the texts acknowledge and really emphasize that karma is bigger than the individual. Right? I bear the karma of my family, of my various identity categories, of my culture. Right? I suffer partly right now because America suffers. Other folks here are having a great time because America is in this particular moment. We all bear the exact result of our various karmas. And so this phrase is poignant. Especially, as I've said before, I very often chant this, and my boy is there, because I wake up early with him. He often sits on my knees when I'm doing morning chanting. He likes to bow to statues. Hashtag bad Buddhist parenting. Or good, who knows, but he likes it. And so he's sitting there, and I have to chant while he's sitting on my knees, this like beautiful little curly-haired cherub. You know, that all that is mine, beloved, and pleasing will become otherwise and be separated from me. And it stings, you know. And then the equanimity phrase is even more complicated in the heart, right? It says all beings, so here's this little being, right, are the owner of their own actions, their own life. And their happiness and unhappiness depends on their own actions, not on my wishes for them. What does this mean? You know, does it mean that I can't care for my son in some way? It doesn't. We remember that the hinge of the whole suffering thing in the teachings is reactivity. That it's not the presence of sickness itself that causes suffering. I have a cold right now, I don't like it, but, you know, I can either hate it and resist it and be really grumpy and suffer more, or I can feel the sensations and be like, this is natural, it's human life, it's parenting, and not actually suffer, not be unhappy in relation to it. We must learn to do this to find happiness, because happiness that's only hinged to pleasant experience is impossible to maintain, right? Thus the reminder, old age, sickness, and death, we keep saying it, to remind us that happiness can't be only the basis of sensual pleasures. Equanimity is a heart practice because it says, how about the happiness that you can have when you're sick? How about the joy, the happiness, the ease of heart you could have as you age, as people you love age, as people you love die? That you actually could still be at ease in the world. That's a shocking proposal for most of us. Even that I could see my boy who, you know, if anything happened to him, I would just be like wrecked, right? And at the same time, every morning chant, essentially like, your life is your own. You know, I'll do everything I can, but I can't prevent you from growing sick, growing old. I can't save him from loss and grief. And that's one of the most poignant things about parenting, and it turns out to be one of the most poignant things about all the forms of love for anyone. That, like, no matter how big you love, you can't save someone from grief. And people would ask the Buddha, you're so powerful, you have supernatural powers, etc., etc., you're fully enlightened, you can talk with the gods, can't you just, like, save someone, can't you enlighten someone else? Can't you, like, open someone else to the liberation that you found? And he would say, I can't, actually. All I can do is point the way. And he had that equanimity. People would come to him who were not savable by him. At one point, a king came to him who had killed his own father to become king. The king came, he was a supporter of the Buddha. The Buddha gave him a magnificent Dharma talk. The king, at the end of the talk, said, thank you, Blessed One, now I have to go, I have a lot of things to do. The Buddha said, you know, what he always says in this, the stock phrase is, now is the time, good sir, to do as you see fit. So he says that to the king goes away. And then after the king leaves, the Buddha says to the monks and nuns that are present, it's really too bad that this king killed his own father. If it wasn't for the weight of that karma in his system, he would have opened to liberation right here during this talk. Like, the Buddha could see that this person was weighed down by their own actions, and that was preventing him from being as available to the wisdom teachings as he could have been. And so the Buddha says, it is a great shame for this king that he did those actions, and that's preventing him from opening to the depth that he could now. But he does it with equanimity. He understands the process of how action colors the rest of our life. So the actions that we have control over are our choices, and how our choices can be used as practice in relation to this reactivity. How we can learn to experience pleasure . I thought that would be pleasurable, and it is. This is a very nice tea. It feels really good on my throat for coughing. That we can learn to experience a mild pleasure, or even a great pleasure, you know, meeting the love of our life, and hold it with that balance of heart. Right? No matter how long I'm with this person, eventually we will lose each other. And that's okay. I neither have to like it nor dislike it. It turns out it can be seen clearly, held with wisdom, and then the love doesn't constrict in the same way as it does when we resist reality. When we fear death, when we fear loss, when we shake our skinny fists like antennas to heaven. What was that album title? Something like that. That's a sort of fringe punk music reference. Sorry, people. When we protest loudly against the gods, you know. So equanimity isn't turning away from the world. It isn't shutting down. It isn't not caring. It looks like those sometimes. And the subtlety of the practice is to not let it slide into nihilism or you know, staying separate from things. And that's also why it's part of the heart practices. It's not considered to be a thing unto itself, separate from love, compassion, etc. So. May the profound quality of balance in the heart arise for all of us, more and more, so that our love in action can be of deep service to the world without the constrictions of fear and grasping. Thank you so much for listening to that. Pleasure to think out loud with you about this subtle quality. And as we always do, some time here too for your thoughts, either about this or any aspect of your practice. Yeah, please, Sierra.
I wasn't here for the beginning couple weeks of this, so I just was hoping for a little context around when it would be appropriate or inappropriate to do the practices, especially I'm thinking in relation to people who are experiencing either a lot of trauma or sickness or something, to say, okay, feel, you know, let's intentionally feel love and feel good.
Yeah.
Is a great thing and might feel a little unattainable or not appropriate for them in the moment. So can you just kind of set up the practice a little bit?
Sure.
Because I missed that.
Sure. And you can go back and listen to the talks from those, of course. But the basis, I would say, in relation to what you're saying, in general, especially in relation to trauma, any of our practices that move toward embodiment, so like sensing the body or cultivating energy or moving toward stronger emotion, all of those can be, you know, triggering in some ways for folks with trauma because they will inevitably touch on the way that the body's been harmed, right? That the heart has been harmed. So for trauma specifically, the foundational practices that I always support are things that are less internal. So you know, open-eyed practice, orienting to the external through the senses, physical activity that isn't subtle sensation-based, you know. And until there's enough of a foundation of a kind of gentle, simple pleasure available. The pleasure of walking in the woods, the pleasure of talking with a friend. And once there's a foundation of those pleasures, then practices like yoga that bring in a kind of gentle, embodied sense, you know, can be wonderful. And then as contact with the body and pleasure is more and more grounded, then meditation and other things that are more internal can become a wonderful support. For everybody, the heart practices are purifications, right? So you suggest to yourself, okay, here's this person I really care for. May you be well. And then some part of you goes, I feel angry, right? Because, you know, you invoke a state and inevitably you get everything that's associated with that state. And so if we invoke love, we get its opposite sometimes. And so that's true for everyone, not just the traumatized. All of these practices, you know, I invoke equanimity, and what I actually get is more aware of how much I'm clinging. I invoke joy and for the good, the well-being of someone else, and I actually find out how much I'm jealous and envious. And this happens sort of again and again, and I keep practicing. The instruction really is just keep going, basically. So for trauma, I would use a foundation of other practices before I got to these, but that eventually they could be really emotionally healing, especially all of them, really. Maybe especially self-love as a very first step. But then for everyone, all of these will always bring up other feelings. And that's just part of the process. Yeah. Yeah. Other thoughts? Yeah, hi.
I just wanted to also add or contribute to that.
Please.
What you were saying is that I've heard you say in the past that, when I was here for some of the beginning of this series, we were talking about, we were doing a meditation where we were invoking love for something, and I remember, immediately the first first thing that comes to my mind is like my googly old cat who's like on the couch, and it's so easy to just like have this sense of like yum and love and sweetness.
Yep.
And I would think that that would be something that's like obtainable, you know what I mean, of just getting into an embodied state of what it feels like to just feel like peace and love and gentleness and kindness towards something that's easy.
Absolutely.
Is like a really good first step.
It's a super good first step. Very classically in these practices, the first step is often a figure known as the benefactor, who's like given a lot to you. Like for monastics, that would be the person who's paying for you, the lay person who's been supporting you all these years. So you have tons of gratitude and love for them. For Westerners, where we don't have that figure in our lives often, or that figure is more complicated, I know a lot of people who have chosen a pet, a cat or a dog, because we love them. And they're not that complicated, you know? Like, I mean, cats are a little complicated, you know? but not like, you know, not like our partners and friends, right? So so that's very encouraged to just, like, wherever you can find exactly that, like, feeling. And it's almost like you find the feeling and you kind of whip it up and you're just like, oh, I love you so much. And then you just sort of bring other people in, and you're like, okay, I love you too, okay, you know, and then you bring in some tough people, you know, the Bannons and Trumps, or whoever it is for you, and you're like, okay, you are snarly old cats, but I know that you suffer, so I, you know, I'll send you some love. And that's how the process goes. You always start with something easy, and then whip it up, and then go from there. So cats and dogs are good for that. What else here? Sir?
I'll add something that I've thought about equanimity. I'm not sure if they're the same or if there's a transition, but patience is something I've been thinking of a while. And there's a teacher who used a phrase in one talk I heard, which was, are you waiting in the moment or are you waiting in the future? I don't know if that's the exact word, but I think it ties in very well with certainly setting up the conditions for equanimity.
Yeah.
And so waiting in the present is, you're waiting with what is. Waiting in the future, you say, oh, I'm being patient. I'm waiting for all the things I want to show up.
Right.
And so, you know, I've noticed the most equanimity come from my practice of patience in this way, which is, just how much, it's wanting things to be other than how they are that is perhaps the antithesis of equanimity.
Right.
In some way.
Exactly. Exactly. Patience is a beautiful quality. There's a Buddhist teacher that actually, recognizing that we can't cause transformation to happen, that all we can do is set up the conditions for it to unfold on its own, says this means that basically the entire path is waiting. You know, you just keep setting up conditions and then you just wait because there's nothing else to do in the moment, and that meditation is the ultimate waiting. Because you don't try to do anything. You can't accomplish meditation through will. So you set everything up, may all beings be well, may I be at peace, and then you just hang out. And you're just like, don't want anything. Oh, I was wanting again. It's like, just relax. You're just waiting. And it's like, just wait.
You know the phrase from the Dhammapada, patience is the highest austerity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites.
Yeah. Patience. It's like equanimity in, you know, action.
That's a good way.
Yeah, please.
Do you think there's any relationship between waiting and ambiguity?
I don't know. Say more.
I don't know. I think about, like, waiting, and I'm okay with waiting, but then sometimes it can shift to being, like, feeling ambiguous, like, you know, maybe, and thoughts around, like, maybe not having a strong opinion about something or not really knowing where I sit.
Yeah.
And then kind of, like, coming out of that being like, oh, maybe I should know what I want. Or maybe, you know, judgments around
that. Right. This is interesting.
I don't know if that makes any sense at all. But
I think it does to people. It does to me. Part of what I hear in this, and this is a really good point, is that equanimity is still part of the path. And so to rest in equanimity partly depends on having a clear view of where we're going in the path. If you don't know what you're trying to cultivate, I think the goal is still going to be ambiguous, and therefore there's going to be some vibration in the heart. Like, should I be doing something different to attain my goal? If I don't know what that is, maybe there's something I should be doing, but I don't know what it is. Equanimity gets to really, really rest when there's wise view. When it's like, I'm hell-bent for full liberation, if one could put it that way. And that means I know that the thing to do is to come to this profound still point with everything fluctuating. Because I know what my goal is, and I've never forgotten it through practice, or I've forgotten it and remembered again, but at this moment I'm remembering it, I think that gives the strength for equanimity to really do nothing in a way that doesn't get ambiguous. Because the thing that is still clear is the goal. And equanimity is not identical with liberation. It's still a heart quality that has... it's being practiced in a certain way. It's still a kind of responsiveness to fluctuating conditions, where full liberation has uprooted the causes of suffering completely, or is in the process of doing so. So the cessation of liberation and the chilled out patience of equanimity are very close by. They're neighbors on the path, but they're not identical. So when there's equanimity as a practice before we're enlightened, we're still aware of where we're going. And in the sequence called the Progress of Insight, once you get to equanimity, which is like step 13 of 16 or something, and the last couple happen in a flash as you near and then follow the moment of liberation, of liberative insight, equanimity has come into your system only after a big fluctuation of like lots of energy, lots of insights, a big kind of crashing dark night where you deal with fear, disgust, and misery as core qualities, and then you realize how you need to just keep practicing, and you recommit to practice after a big dark patch, and rising up out of that dark patch, having dealt with suffering and some really big sort of flashy highs closer to the beginning of the path kind of goes like, really, really, really hard, oh my God, boom. Like, I don't know what that is. Like, you fall off a surfboard and get tumbled. And then you rise up, and it's like, okay, still here. And from there, this, like, of equanimity can happen, where you're just like, all right, I can do it. I can do anything it throws at me, because you've been to both extremes. And it's interesting how that's the same process in the sequence of the Brahmaviharas. You have deep compassion for suffering, deep celebration for joy, and then you chill out with, like, I can deal with the extremes, now I'm just here. And once you land at that, there's nothing more to develop. You just wait. And when it's ripe, it just turns. And so from equanimity, that the moment of cessation appears by itself. And equanimity is the long pause with balanced attention before that happens. So all of this comes back to view, right? We have to know where we're headed. If you don't want liberation, you won't be able to cultivate the conditions necessary for it to arise. Cool. That's a nice cosmic kind of big place to end. Pause there for tonight. Thank you so much for your presence, your warm attention. The fact of the situation here changing away from the donation model means that the way they were able to allow us to have two more weeks to finish out August is that I signed a volunteer agreement. So tonight and next week are legally completely free. So no donations allowed. You're welcome to offer gratitude and warmth. We will find a new wonderful home. So that might be... So there's these three kind of main possibilities that are circling around now, and at least a couple of them are really actually kind of exciting to me. That we'll be in a new space with new people, new new energy, new kinds of support, and for other offerings as well, other kind of expanding other kinds of practice. So I'm actually really looking forward to that, and I've been teaching in this space ever since it was Yoga Mandala, ever since it was a fringe tantric studio with a massive statue of Durga in the corner. So it's poignant to leave it, but I kind of suspect that I won't even look back. So please come along, and so we'll see you next week. Next week, it'll be our last week here. I will talk about gratitude, probably because we talked about it last week in such a beautiful way. Nina talked about it beautifully. And it's a beautiful way to end a month on the heart practices and to end our time here. We'll bless the space. Bring some snacks if you want to share. We'll have a little party. We'll do our full chanting puja. So we'll take refuge, chant the precepts, remind ourselves of old age, sickness, and death, and then we'll eat some chocolate. So blessings to everyone. See you soon. Thank you.